Hello, and welcome to Dialogues Dispatch, a podcast series from Google on technology and society. I'm Yasmin Green, the CEO of Jigsaw, and for today's dispatch, I'm delighted to be joined by author, academic, diplomat, podcast sensation, Rory Stewart, in a conversation on AI and its potential impact on democracy, geopolitics, and the role of policy in getting AI right for society.
Hello, thank you for having me.
All right, before we talk about AI, let's take a step back. A healthy democracy requires productive deliberation and debate, a free marketplace of ideas, a public who are engaged and holding power to account. The original vision for the internet, even up until two decades ago, was of a democratizing force. From your vantage points, in what ways has the internet delivered on that mission or not?
Well, I think sadly, if you actually look at the evolution of democracies, from about 1988 to 2004, the number of democracies in the world doubles. About 2004 onwards, it begins to flatline. And from 2014, the number of democracies has begun to drop. And unfortunately, this story I'm telling you also coincides with a massive revolution in technology. It's not just because of the revolution in technology, 2008 financial crisis, but definitely social media has been a huge part of the problem. And it's largely because traditional democratic politics was about compromise, was about finding common ground, was about the idea of persuading somebody else. Whereas the algorithms of X, of Facebook, are increasingly polarizing, are increasingly about getting attention by making extreme and uncompromising comments. And given that that's part of human nature anyway, it makes it very difficult for democracy. We're now going into an election in the US where almost whoever wins, half the population are going to be very, very angry. And this is not good because it's moving beyond the general idea of politics as a relatively, a tough game, but a game with rules which everybody respects, where losers accept results, where winners respect the Constitution, to a world that feels much more raw and less democratic. And unfortunately, that does coincide with a lot of developments in technology.
I do reflect on the fact that if you look around the world and ask yourselves which countries have an internet that aligns with their governing ideology, it is actually the countries that are more repressive. So like the CCP has the Great Firewall of China, which they feel like is aligned with their communism, certainly with Chinese characteristics. In Iran, where I'm from, they have the halal internet. The clergy want to remove things that are immoral. It's interesting to reflect on, I suppose, in open societies, what should we be aspiring to in terms of the attributes of the internet that would foster democracy?
Well, I think democracy is fundamentally about persuasion. As I say, it's about argument persuasion. It's about trying to use intellect, emotional, and ethical argument to shift people's positions. And it's also about respect, radical respect. It's about understanding that you, about many things, are going to know much more than I do. I might be the elected politician, but there'll be so many things you know far more about than I do. So I guess the question would be, how could you use the internet or any form of technology to develop deeper, more thoughtful conversations?
You have said in more optimistic moments about the internet that you think that it's enabled elected officials and others maybe to be more open. You know, there's a normalizing of just the humanity of us. Do you think that that still is true of the internet?
It is incredibly empowering. I mean, I ran to be prime minister. I ran to be mayor of London, and I found that it's amazing the access it gives, the way that you can generate a campaign from almost nothing, the way that you can crowdsource money, that you're not dependent on big donors in the same way. You can create a brand and you can be like Macron in France, which would be almost unimaginable without technology and the internet. So I think it can be a force for the progressive central ground, but too often, unfortunately, it's a polarization. So I'm going to turn it around. Where do you feel that you've seen the most positive relationship between internet and democracy?
I think that we're all there, which is nice. Without a digital public square, you're not living in an open society. And indeed, that's what the situation is in China and Iran. They're not free to voice their opinions or dissent. In fact, they have a much easier job of designing an internet that they like, because anything, any dissenting viewpoint, they can get rid of. But we have the harder job in open societies that we want ideas to come into contact with each other and into conflict with each other. The problem, I think, today is that the conflict is not productive. It's not leading to respect or pluralism or compromise. And I think that's partly because of the way that social spaces are organized. So one of the things that Jigsaw does is we have a tool that we've built that's the most popular free tool for moderating social spaces for news publishers. New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Wikipedia, Reddit, they all use our tech. 2 billion comments a day. But it is about finding toxic comments of different types, insults, threats, and removing them or demoting them. And so the question we've been asking ourselves for the last year is, what are the attributes of discourse that would allow us to hear opposing viewpoints in a way that is productive and healthy? If you had to riff now, what are the attributes of discourse that you would like to see privileged in social spaces?
The fundamental problem in politics is politicians today are largely trying to mobilize their base against the other. It's a highly divisive form of politics. So they don't really believe in the possibility of persuasion. Definitely don't believe in the possibility of education. Politicians attempt to win by saying, this is my tribe. I'm going to absolutely get my tribe out to vote, and I'm going to crush and destroy the other side. I went through this in the Brexit referendum in the UK. We ended up in a world in which about a quarter of Brexit voters and Remain voters said they wouldn't contemplate even speaking to the other side, and half of them said they wouldn't contemplate their child marrying someone who voted in the other direction. Mm. So I was trying to bring together a sort of compromise, soft Brexit, custom teeth. And it was fascinating that there weren't really the institutions or the practices to say to a Brexit voter and a Remain voter, can we compromise?
Mm.
Okay, you voted to leave, but can we try to find something that accepts that this was a 52-48 quite close vote? And I think it's not just about the politician persuading the voter, it's about the voter also persuading the politician. It's this sort of element of openness and radical humility, but our culture, and I don't know to what extent you can fix this with technology, is not really about listening thoughtfully and carefully. It's about very rapid sound bites. And we can see this emerging statistically. The average kind of political soundbite in the 1960s, about 3.5 minutes, went on down to a matter of seconds.
You've spoken before about citizen assemblies. I'm curious why you think that that's a promising approach to deliberation. And then also if you think that the internet and AI could scale that model, or if we could transform some of our public spaces into something that takes the best of citizen assemblies and brings us closer to productive disagreement.
What is a citizen assembly? Well, a citizen assembly is like a jury. It's a randomly selected group of people, could be 200-300 people, demographically representative of a country, put in a room with an expert facilitator over 2-3 days to talk about a big policy issue. People gather in a room, pretty much 50-50 on either side, and work their way towards a solution. And one of the things citizen assemblies do is they go from the abstract, you know, are you for it or are you against it, to the detail.
Mm-hmm.
So if you imagine something like immigration, which is, you know, probably the biggest single political problem in every developed country now. It's what driving the far right. It's what will drive the US election. The conversation that you need to get to is not, are you pro-immigration or are you against immigration? But what kind of immigration do you want? How many people do you want? And understand what the implications of those figures are for different sectors of the economy and your long-term trajectory.
Right.
So I think citizens' assemblies are the way of breaking the deadlock of these political parties, their funding structures. I really believe in the wisdom of ordinary people, and I think it's a form of incredibly powerful representation and brings democracy closer to people. So how could you, how could Jigsaw, how could Google, how could the internet enable that? Well, I think one of the big challenges for citizens' assemblies is barriers of distance and problems of time. You're asking ordinary citizens with everyday jobs to deliberate and work together. So I think insofar as the internet is an amazing way of jumping a barrier of distance, it's essential. Mm-hmm. But it could also be a very interesting way for gathering conversations, for finding ways of selecting representatives from within the group, because you often see them as rapporteurs, a way of presenting information to them.
That's a really great example. So some of the things that we are trying to model now with the more powerful large language models are things like constructiveness, basically, is a point well explained. Curiosity. I know intuitively when someone's asking me a question, to get ammunition to shoot at me versus to try to understand my point of view. Personal anecdotes. So I think that probably comes out actually in citizen assemblies, but when people share lived experience, that evokes empathy. So lots of attributes of language that are viewpoint agnostic that, you know, could promote the likelihood that we would really engage.
You're doing something fascinating there. Getting the balance right is very difficult because I think some of the more empathetic language models that have been developed, I'm slightly worried about. I'm worried that they sort of lose trust because they're being too cutesy at the attempts to use personal anecdotes and human connection, whereas the slightly more austere, guardrailed, fact-based things may actually be what you're really looking for in a democratic deliberation. You may not actually want the AI to be cracking little jokes and trying to be your buddy. What you may actually want it to do is to break down the alcohol debate into ten salient points, produce seven important examples around the world.
Right. I think actually you're coming to the next point, because what we're doing is just helping, you know, the keepers of the public square who have social spaces to be able to evaluate all the possible comments they have and then rank them accordingly, not to generate original content. But we are about to enter into a world where many more people will be able to generate synthetic content with chatbots. And so I think it's interesting to play this forward and imagine when you consider the year we have ahead with elections and the generative AI revolution, what concerns you?
Well, I think the big concern with AI, particularly large language models, and this big year, so this huge year, whether it's going to be elections in, you know, India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, Mexico, the European Union, Russia, UK, US, is of course that we have sketched out the regulation end of 2023, but it's not going to be implemented in practice for a year or 18 months. So we're in a gap between seeing what the risks are and actually implementing the solution. The other thing, I mean, is that it is an amazing potential generator for conspiracy theories, sort of QAnon-style conspiracy theories. I mean, QAnon's quite smart, but any large language model could develop 1,000 QAnons in a second and be able to immediately adjust them to the particular user and the particular... And I'm aware of this because when I was running for election, I had a number of professional campaign organizations coming to me saying they'd run elections in 50 countries and they were proposing to set up bots for me, sock puppets for me, set up fake news, dominate the way in which algorithms work on various social media accounts to effectively leverage me into victory. Those same companies will now be selling this on AI in a much, much, much bigger way. And people will find it very difficult to resist. The idea that any politician anywhere around the world is going to be able to resist somebody saying, I can get you another 7 percentage points in this election by doing something really clever with AI, even if it's a bit naughty.
Right. Rory, what are governments getting right? What's been encouraging to you to see, and where do you think governments, because they're not the sole actor here, but what would you like to see governments doing more of?
So the first thing to be cheerful about is the fact that people like Joe Biden, who, you know, wouldn't pretend to his closest friend to be a kind of expert in AI, has nevertheless really lent in to try to understand it. I think the second thing is that the solutions they've produced imply that they are getting quite thoughtful, serious advice, and they're listening to people. Doesn't feel crazy or politically motivated. And broadly speaking, I think they seem to firstly acknowledge there are huge risks, but they're also very, very aware of the incredible potential. They're very conscious that technology always comes with risks, but that this could be the moment where finally we see computers in the productivity statistics. I mean, this has been the great problem for the last 40 years, right? But this finally could be the moment with AI where we actually see astonishing productivity gains, astonishing impact on economic growth. And that is desperately needed, particularly in the developed world, but not just the developed world. I mean, if you know, we tend to think the problem is that the German economy is stagnating, the French economy is stagnating, British economy is stagnating. But China is facing a very significant challenge now. And China is, of course, you know, 18% of the world economy. But it's very difficult structurally to work out how China's going to be able to generate the 4-5% growth that not just it needs, but the world needs to keep the engine going. And that's where things like AI become really interesting, because you can absolutely imagine not just existing tasks being performed for a fraction of the cost of the fraction of the workforce, which is kind of normal productivity gain. You can imagine completely new ways of doing this. Now, that is the challenge for the politician.
Yeah.
Are they really prepared to be really radical and brave? Are they prepared to reimagine whole institutions?
If we were designing policies to democracy is at its best on a question like that, like what happens to the jobs that we think are affected by AI? What would be the sausage making of that policy? Who would you solicit input from? What kind of analysis would you do?
Well, if you want to look at the big question is what happens to people who lose their jobs to AI? And let's imagine a service economy like the UK. And it's not just the UK. I mean, think about somewhere like Kenya. So Kenya, low middle income country, it's bet very hard that its growth trajectory is call centers and software development. What do we know about AI? The first two sectors it wipes out is call centers and software development. So the question then is, what does one do, whether in Kenya or the UK? And there's something slightly misleading about the idea of, well, we just reskill everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's fine, you know, reskilling maybe an accountant, lawyer with 3 degrees and certain amount of savings and a huge network of social contacts. It's a different thing, you know, reskilling 450,000 truck drivers who suddenly had their jobs replaced by autonomous vehicles and are 40 years old. So there are public policy things that you can do, but one of the reasons you have to get the public involved is that you have to begin partly in a process of education, of being realistic about the challenges, showing people what the costs are, showing people what the real choices are, and letting people work through.
Right.
And sometimes what societies may decide to do is they may decide that they don't want to push ahead with the most productive thing immediately. They right. may be like, well, okay, if you're literally saying 500,000 people are about to lose their jobs driving trucks, maybe we're not going to fast forward quite as quickly as we thought we were going to do with the autonomous trucks. Maybe we're going to bring it in over 10 years or 15 years, even if it's not the most economically efficient way.
What is the gold standard for public policymaking in a context like that? It's such a daunting task setting public policy against the backdrop of such, you know, transformative change.
The key to it is extreme localization. The key to it is understanding that you cannot answer the question on what this area of Michigan or this area of Newcastle needs from Washington or London. You have to have functioning local democracies with empowered citizens, with information, but above all, with budgets and legal power. Because the key point is that if you're losing jobs in Michigan or you're losing jobs in Newcastle, you need somebody hyper-local
right.
to begin to think about what is the most practical way of generating stuff that gets people working again. And that may well be, we understand that actually, you know, we have a strength, I don't know, in the music industry in Manchester, and we're going to set up vocational training to try to generate more sound engineers.
Mm-hmm. Maybe full circle to citizen assemblies again. There's one example, the software that Vitae One's based on is called Polis. There's one example of using Polis to come up with fisheries policy in the UK. They went into the community, spent time with people, really patient type of research where you just observe people in their habitat and, you know, understand the issues. Then they did this tech facilitated process of soliciting input, mapped it, figured out where there was agreement and developed policy. Seemed to me like the gold standard in process where they did an ethnographic study first.
Yeah. Well, I mean, another great example, which I think will be hugely important, is the use of technology on delivering unconditional cash transfers to people. Google's done this in a whole series of different ways. It's done it through supportive organizations like GiveDirectly, doing it in terms of dealing with extreme poverty. And that's about using complete revolution payment mechanisms and mobile telephones to deliver money to extreme poor. It's done it through anticipated reaction. So using AI to anticipate climate moves, because it makes all the difference in the world if you can get the cash to someone before the flood hits, because they can move their livestock, move their families, they can take preventative measures. Whereas if you give them cash after the flood hits, it costs 10 times as much and their lands are destroyed. Now, why does this matter? This matters because democracy, politics, isn't just about our conversations about truck drivers. It's about floods and droughts, wiping out people and how we respond. And it's also about what do we do when wealth gets concentrated in different ways to redistribute? How do we do transfer payments to the poor? Are we going to need some form of universal basic income? I think that sort of thing is going to be very interesting and wasn't possible before technology in two ways. Mm-hmm. Wasn't possible without the payment mechanism, but also wasn't possible because we weren't able to do the randomized control trials to demonstrate counterintuitive things like giving up conditional cash has much more impact than a traditional development project.
I'm left with this sense of the enormity of change that is going to be upon us with the new technologies and the amount of transformation that we're going to need to do, and that talking and listening, whether we do it online or in person, is going to make the difference between whether we prepare and prepare meaningfully. So thanks for kind of modeling that a little bit with me today.
If we're going to make this work, I think we need a very, very counterintuitive philosophy. We need technologists and engineers, but we need to do something which engineers find uncomfortable, because the only way of doing this societally is not by producing universal technical solutions and imposing them in a one-size-fits-all way on societies. It's actually about getting out on the ground, getting to very remote areas, really asking, what exactly is this doing in this place? Listening hard, empathizing, and finding a way of trusting people, and trusting them sometimes when they push back and say, actually, this technology really isn't working for me. It isn't having the results you wanted. And maybe the solution here isn't a technological solution at all. So I think that we need to move into a world where we retain our optimism for technology, our belief in technology, without falling into the trap of thinking that somehow politics can be fixed by technology on its own.
So rather than being AI-centered or tech-centered, like we have AI, let's see where we can sprinkle it, what would be the more profound articulation of what we're striving for?
We're striving for citizenship. It's about giving voice to people. It's about trusting their human nature, their instincts, their knowledge, their ability to know what's best for their immediate surroundings. It's about trying to get back to what democracy comes from. Democracy comes from little city-states in ancient Greece, 40,000 people, like a citizens' assembly. That's what gives the life to it. What we cannot do is continue down the path of these very, very distant representative democracies where 100 senators claim to represent, you know, 300 million people. It's mad. I don't represent you. How can I speak for you? This is central to politics. We're representing people that we have no right to represent. What we need to get towards is allowing people to speak for themselves, but also listen and be persuaded by others.
Well, that's beautiful. Thank you for articulating it so well. I'll take that with me. Thank you, Rory.
Thank you.
Cheers.